London, England, 2 months later. Chapter 3.
Victoria, this is Victoria Station.
A burly, blue-uniformed conductor moves through on his way to the back of our train, announcing that I've arrived in London at last. We're slowing to a stop. Great billowing clouds of steam sail past the window, making everything outside seem like a dream. In the seat across from me, my brother, Tom, is waking, straightening his black waistcoat, checking for anything that isn't perfect. In the 4 years we've been apart, he has grown very tall and a little broader in the chest, but he's still thin, with a flop of fair hair that droops fashionably into his blue eyes and makes him seem younger than 20.
Try not to look so dour, Gemma. It's not as if you're being sent to the stocks. Spence is a very good school with a reputation for turning out charming young ladies.
A very good school. Charming young ladies. It is, word for word, what my grandmother said after we'd spent 2 weeks at Pleasant House, her home in the English countryside. She'd taken a long, appraising look at me, with my freckled skin and unruly mane of red hair, my sullen face, and decided that a proper finishing school was what was needed if I were ever to make a decent marriage.
"It's a wonder you weren't sent home years ago," she clucked. "Everyone knows the climate in India isn't good for the blood. I'm sure this is what your mother would want."
I had to bite my tongue to keep from asking how she could possibly know what my mother would want. My mother had wanted me to stay in India. I had wanted to come to London, and now that I'm here, I couldn't be more miserable. For 3 hours, as the train made its way past green, hilly pastures and the rain slapped wearily at the train's windows, Tom had slept. But I could only see behind me, from where I'd come, the hot plains of India, the police asking questions. Had I seen anyone? Did my mother have enemies? What was I doing alone on the streets? And what about the man who'd spoken to her in the marketplace, a merchant named Amar? Did I know him? Were he and my mother, and here they looked embarrassed and shuffled their feet while finding a word that wouldn't seem too indelicate, acquainted? How could I tell them what I'd seen? I didn't know whether to believe it myself. Outside the train's windows, England still in bloom. But the jostling of the passenger car reminds me of the ship that carried us from India over rough seas, the coastline of England taking shape before me like a warning. My mother buried deep in the cold, unforgiving ground of England. My father staring glassy-eyed at the headstone. Virginia Doyle, beloved wife and mother, peering through it as if he could change what had happened through will alone. And when he couldn't, he retired to his study and the laudanum bottle that had become his constant companion. Sometimes I'd find him asleep in his chair, the dogs at his feet, the brown bottle close at hand, his breath strong and medicinally sweet. Once a large man, he'd grown thinner, whittled down by grief and opium. And I could only stand by, helpless and mute, the cause of it all. The keeper of a secret so terrible it made me afraid to speak, scared that it would pour out of me like kerosene, burning everyone.
"You're brooding again,"
Tom says, casting a suspicious look my way. "Sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. So sorry for everything." Tom exhales long and hard, his voice travelling swiftly under it.
"Don't be sorry. Just stop."
"Yes, sorry," I say again, without thinking. I touch the outline of my mother's amulet. It hangs around my neck now, a remembrance of my mother and my guilt, hidden beneath the stiff black crepe mourning dress I will wear for 6 months. Through the thinning haze outside our window, I can see porters hustling alongside the train, keeping pace, ready to place wooden steps beside the open doors for our descent to the platform. At last our train comes to a stop in a hiss and sigh of steam. Tom stands and stretches.
"Come on then, let's go before all the porters are taken."
Victoria Station takes my breath away with its busyness. Hordes of people mill about the platform. Down at the far end of the train, the third-class passengers climb off in a thick tumble of arms and legs. Porters hurry to carry luggage and parcels for the first-class passengers. Newsboys hold the day's papers in the air as far as their arms will stretch, screeching the most enticing headlines. Flower girls wander about, wearing smiles as hard and worn as the wooden trays that hang from their delicate necks. I'm nearly upended by a man buzzing past, his umbrella parked beneath his arm. "Pardon me," I mutter, deeply annoyed. He takes no note of me. When I glance to the far end of the platform, I catch sight of something odd. A black travelling cloak that sets my heart beating faster. My mouth goes dry. It's impossible that he could be here. And yet, I'm sure it's him disappearing behind a kiosk. I try to get closer, but it's terribly crowded.
"What are you doing?"
Tom asks as I strain against the tide of the crowd. "Just looking," I say, hoping he can't read the fear in my voice. A man rounds the corner of the kiosk, carrying a bundle of newspapers on his shoulder. His coat, thin and black and several sizes too big, hangs on him like a loose cape. I nearly laugh with relief. "You see, Gemma, you're imagining things. Leave it alone."
"Well, if you're going to look around, see if you can find us a porter. I don't know where the devil they've all got to so fast."
A scrawny newsboy happens by and offers to fetch us a hansom cab for 2 pence. He struggles to carry the trunk filled with my few worldly belongings. A handful of dresses, my mother's social diary, a red sari, a white carved elephant from India, and my father's treasured cricket bat. A reminder of him in happier days. Tom helps me into the carriage and the driver pulls away from the great sprawling lady that is Victoria Station, clip-clopping toward the heart of London. The air is gloomy, alive with the smoke from the gaslights that line London's streets. The foggy greyness makes it seem like dusk, though it's only 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Anything could creep up behind you on such shadowy streets. I don't know why I think of this, but I do, and I immediately push the thought away. The needle-thin spires of Parliament peek up over the dusky outlines of chimneys. In the streets, several sweat-drenched men dig deep trenches in the cobblestones. "What are they doing?"
"Putting in lines for electric lights,"
Tom answers, coughing into a white handkerchief with his initials stitched on a corner in a distinguished black script.
"Soon, this choking gaslight will be a thing of the past."
On the streets, vendors hawk their wares from carts, each with his own distinctive cry.
"Knives sharpened! Fish to buy! Get your apples! Apples here!"
Milkmaids deliver the last of the day's milk. In a strange way, it all reminds me of India. There are tempting storefronts for everything one can imagine. Tea, linens, china, and beautiful dresses copied from the best fashions of Paris. A sign hanging from a second-story window announces that there are offices to let. Inquire within. Bicycles whiz past the many handsome cabs on the streets. I brace myself in case the horse spooks to see them, but the mare pulling us seems completely uninterested. She's seen it all before, even if I haven't. An omnibus crowded with passengers sails past us, drawn by a team of magnificent horses. A cluster of ladies sits perched in the seats above the omnibus, their parasols open to shield them from the elements. A long strip of wood advertising Pears soap ingeniously hides their ankles from view, for modesty's sake. It's an extraordinary sight, and I can't help wishing we could just keep riding through London streets, breathing in the dust of history that I've only seen in photographs. Men in dark suits and bowler hats step out of offices, marching confidently home after a day's work. I can see the white dome of St. Paul's Cathedral rising above the sooty rooftops. A posted bill promises a production of Macbeth, starring the American actress Lily Trimble. She's ravishing, with her auburn hair loose and wild, a red gown cut daringly low on her bosom. I wonder if the girls at Spence will be as lovely and sophisticated.